This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Hosting this program has been an unforgettable experience. Before I move on to my next adventure, we wanted to look back on some of my favorite shows. A big thing we try to do with this program is facilitate conversations between people who do not always see eye to eye, to remind America that even in this age of increased polarization, we can still find connection and belonging. That's why I've always loved social scientist Brené Brown. She gained fame after her TED Talk on shame and vulnerability went viral. She's a research professor at the University of Houston and the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, including her latest book, Dare to Lead. We've spoken to her twice, including in 2017, right after Hurricane Harvey devastated Houston. The storm did more than $125 billion of damage. We began by asking her about the hurricane and what a catastrophe can teach us about empathy and connection. Brené Brown, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Joshua. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you on the program. We wanted to talk to you for some time, but before we get into the book, I want to start off with something more immediate, I think. You are based at the University of Houston. You had put out a plea on Facebook after Hurricane Harvey for people to make donations, particularly donations of clean underwear, which is something that people may not consider during a disaster. Your work deals with empathy, vulnerability, connection, kindness, etc. I imagine that the events of the last few weeks, dealing with hurricanes in particular, are showing you something about how those values play out when the chips are down.
I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, they had an emergency call for social workers at NRG, one of our big stadiums that was being, they had set it up as a shelter. Baker Whipley, one of our large neighborhood centers, had set it up. And so they had a mandatory call for social workers. So I went to volunteer and I was struck by how many people just said, you know, I got airlifted by the Coast Guard. I came in on a boat. I have, you know, people were donating clothes just left and right, but no one donates used underwear, obviously. And I thought, let me just go on Facebook Live and just say, look, we need, you know, because I have a community on Facebook that does not need things to be pretty or wrapped in a bow. They kind of dig on honesty. And so I said, we need underwear. And I think we've received maybe 500,000 or 600,000 pair of men's underwear, women's children. It's just been incredible to watch. I mean, we had about 6 feet of water in our neighborhood, and my husband was out on a kayak helping families get out of their houses and pull their pets out. And it's just, we came together in a way that I know is possible for not just Houston or Texas, but for the world. And it was a heartbreaking time, and there's still a lot of heartbreak, but there were also a lot of really deep gifts embedded in what we've been going through. And of course, what everyone's going through with Irma right now.
How's your home? Are you and your family okay?
We are okay. We did not get water. Our home was torn down after Allison and rebuilt under new kind of FEMA standards. So we were high, but everyone around us is everything they own's in the front, and it's tough.
Do you see a difference in situations like this between empathy and charity?
You know, it's a really good question, because one of the things I do in my work often is make the distinction between empathy and sympathy.
Yeah.
And I think charity can ride both of those lines. So empathy is I feel with you, and sympathy is I feel for you. And what my data were very clear in demonstrating is that empathy builds connection. It makes people feel less alone. Sympathy drives disconnection. Sympathy is, I'm sorry for you, you poor thing. The Texas version of, you know, bless your heart. And so I think charity can both be given in the spirit of empathy, kind of there, but for the grace of God. And so when it's my turn, I'll need you to step up. And it can also be done in the name of sympathy, which is, I feel sorry for you, here you go. And so I think what I have seen in Houston, even, you know, panties coming from all over the world, is real empathy, a real sense of we all need and we all, you know, and we all can give, and we'll take turns and be there for each other. So I think that's the real power.
Let me get a little closer to the mainstream of your work, and we'll talk more about your book, Braving the Wilderness.
Sure.
I wonder how you are navigating being you right now. I mean, this TED Talk went bananas and people loved it. And then the next TED Talk you gave, you talked about how you weren't ready to deal with the fame from the first TED Talk. And now there's even more fame because then Oprah Winfrey called you and then you put out this other book and now you're on this tour and the seats are sold out. And I am just wondering how you are right now, considering that this whirlwind just keeps spinning and it's all your fault. Shame on you for being so good at this. How are you navigating all this?
I don't know. this is nervous laughter. it really is. I'm like, holy crap, I'm not sure. I don't know how I'm doing actually. Okay, let me think about it. And let me just tell you for sure, I'm a pauser. Okay, so I am grateful. I'm shocked. And I am grounded. So I'm grateful for a community of people who are willing to engage in these hard conversations with me. And I am shocked. When we did the book tour for Braving the Wilderness, we decided to move to really what I thought were huge venues. Like, I was like, no. And the fact that everything sold out was shocking, and it still is. And I'm also grounded. You know, people ask me this question different. No one's asked me as pointedly as you have, Joshua. So I'll give you that for sure. Like, how the heck are you doing? But, I just got a text from my son that said, have you seen my good goggles? You know, he's got water polo practice and swim practice. And, I'm really grounded. Like, I stay very clear about what matters. And so Steve, my kids, my friends, the research. And so I think one of the things that's been very helpful for me over the last 5 years is I've always asked a single question about every opportunity that has come. And that is, does it serve my work? Does it serve the research? Because I feel like when people sit down across from me and share really hard things, they make me stewards of this work. And so if it serves the work, I'm going to do it. And if it doesn't serve the work, even if I don't want to or I'm uncomfortable, I'm still going to do it. And if it doesn't serve the work, it just serves fame or celebrity or something that I'm really not interested in, I just say no. So I feel pretty grounded, but I am. It has been a whirlwind. And I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm also a really big introvert.
You write about that in the book, you're not kind of wired for this publicity and guruship.
No, I don't like the guru part at all. Like, oof, I don't want to be anyone's guru. Like, trust me, you don't want me as a guru.
Well, I think one of the things that we should definitely get into as we continue our conversation with Brené Brown on her book, Braving the Wilderness, is some of what you've learned through your research about some of these principles, particularly this idea of true belonging. Now, you describe yourself as a qualitative researcher rather than a quantitative researcher, meaning you have people kind of tell their stories and you draw patterns from their stories. Give me your definition of what you call true belonging as you learned from your research.
It actually surprised me. I mean, my research has a tendency just to kick my butt for about a year and a half and challenge everything that I'm doing in my own life. And then I write about it once I can see straight again. And so I always thought belonging was something we negotiated externally. I always thought it was about being a part of something bigger than us. And as it turns out, true belonging is very much a spiritual practice, and it's about belonging to yourself and believing in yourself so deeply that you find sacred both being a part of something, but also standing alone when called to do that. And I think the thing that I love most about true belonging is when we really belong, we're never asked to change who we authentically are. Belonging demands that we be who we are. And so for me, the big ahas in this research were the fact that sometimes true belonging requires standing alone, and that assessing situations and groups of people and then acclimating to fit in is a huge barrier to real belonging.
There's a line before we pause, take our first break. There's a line in Braving the Wilderness. I read the book, and there's one of the early things that you talk about in terms of the spiritual crisis we're in. You write, quote, "The world feels high lonesome and heartbroken to me right now. We've sorted ourselves into factions based on our politics and ideology. We've turned away from one another and toward blame and rage. We're lonely and untethered and scared. So damn scared," unquote. Before we have to take our first break, what's the connection that you're trying to draw between today's lack of civility and this sense of true belonging?
Well, here's the thing that I found shocking is at the very same time we are sorting ourselves into ideological factions and bunkers. And the research shows this clearly, not just my research, but everyone who studies social science shows that we are in factions, literally, the way we live, worship, go to school. At the same time we've sorted ourselves into these factions, we are becoming increasingly lonelier. Like, you would think the factions would at least deliver on some good connection with like-minded people. But the truth is, we are bunkered up and lonely because the connection that happens between those bunkers is not authentic connection. It's what I call common enemy intimacy. We just hate the same people.
Yeah. I do want to talk further as we continue about some practical things that we can do to deal with that incivility, particularly a question from Katie in Kingston, Illinois. Katie emailed, "What do we do if we find disrespectful language on Facebook? Do we speak up? How? Or do we avoid the accusation of trolling?" We'll get into some more of those practical questions as we continue our conversation with Brené Brown. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Today we're looking back at some of my personal favorite conversations from my time as host. Today's program originally aired back in 2017, right after Hurricane Harvey hit Houston. We spoke to Brené Brown, a social scientist and research professor at the University of Houston. Brown's written 5 New York Times bestsellers, including Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. I asked her about that book and about finding true belonging inside yourself. Brené Brown, how did this book come about? Was it something about today's political climate that inspired you to start working on this? Or was this something that you happened to be working on when things became less civil?
Yeah, it was really about my interest in belonging. It was trying to get into, what does it take to be a part of something in a meaningful way? And in fact, I had no intention of writing about this kind of polarized culture that we live in right now. But as it turns out, you can't write a book on connection and belonging without being really honest about how difficult it is today, given the level of vitriol and mean-spiritedness. And so as I started talking about belonging in the research and getting into it, I thought, you know, when I interview people today, they always talk about it. They always talk about how hard it is. Because imagine if part of belonging is the courage to stand alone and belong to yourself first, not to betray your own ideas and values when you're with a group of people, how difficult that's become in the last year.
Yeah. I wonder if we could clarify this concept a little bit in terms of belonging, particularly in light of an email from Jacqueline, who wrote in. She says she's a big fan, and Jacqueline writes, "I am a mixed-race Native American woman, a nurse, wife, mother, storyteller, dancer, and a pretty ferocious person. But I am aware of the energy it takes to feel a genuine sense of belonging within the dominant culture. I was lucky enough to have parents who encouraged me to march to my own drum, but the reality is that I have to constantly straddle 2 worlds, that of the consumer-driven white Christian culture and my own traditional non-white, non-Christian self. How do we find a sense of belonging in the divisive climate in the world today?" I think, Dr. Brown, part of what she's talking about, at least in part, is the difference, and you describe this in the book, between belonging and fitting in.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I heard when it's such a powerful and beautiful question. I think Fitting in actually emerged from the data as the greatest barrier to belonging. Fitting in is acclimating. Fitting in is acculturation. Fitting in is, what am I supposed to do, say, feel, and believe in order to not be challenged and not to push on this group, whether it's majority culture, whether it's a group that you belong to, it doesn't, you know, what do I have to do to fit in? And fitting in is a very hollow substitute for belonging. And it's hard because it's kind of our default in this culture for all of us, because belonging is so, we're so neurobiologically hardwired from mirror neurons down to, for belonging, to be a part of something. We're so hardwired for connection that the first thing we end up doing is sacrificing ourselves and who we are to achieve it. But when we choose fitting in, the connection is not real. And we actually can feel lonelier than if we would have maintained our kind of our beliefs and our values and our integrity. And so I think fitting in, the idea that fitting in and belonging are synonymous, is one of the huge myths of belonging. They're just absolutely not the same thing. I think what changed me personally the most, you know, just as a person, but also as a parent and a partner, is this idea that we can never belong to a group of people in a stronger way than we belong to ourselves. That true belonging is something we carry in our hearts, and it's not something we negotiate externally with groups of people. And so I think the goal is, you know, I think before this research, if one of my kids would have come home and said, you know, everyone got invited to this slumber party but me, and my feelings are really hurt, I think my first goal would have been to figure out why they didn't fit in, why they were being left out, and to change that. Huh. And now what I think, now my default is, my job is to make sure you belong to you and that you know your self-worth, not that you can ease your way in to fitting in or belonging with other people, because it doesn't work that way.
You describe in the book that one of the things that provoked you in this concept of true belonging that kind of lingered with you was an interview between Bill Moyers and the late Maya Angelou. Here is the clip from that interview that you reference in the book. Listen.
Well, at some point, you only are free when you realize you belong no place. You belong every place, no place at all. The price is high. The reward is great.
That's Maya Angelou speaking to Bill Moyers in an interview on public television back in 1973. And Brené, you said in the book that when you heard that, for a long time you thought, well, that's wrong. How can somebody belong no place and every place? And something about that just raked you as not making sense.
Yeah, I'm feeling very teary. I didn't know you had that clip. Yeah, it's a very powerful thing. You know, Maya Angelou has always been a constant guide for me in my life. I discovered her 30 years ago when I was a poetry major for a brief period of time. I've hung on every word that she has said, written, you know, just sang. Just, I love her work. But when I came across this quote, it actually kind of pissed me off. I was angry. Like, I thought, how can someone so wise say that true freedom is belonging nowhere, everywhere? Because as someone who has always struggled with belonging, I feel like I can mark my life by not belonging. From the time I was in kindergarten, high school, college, even now, I really struggle with belonging because I don't find a lot of other people who think like me or their jobs look like mine. And I struggle. So I'm like, God, you know, Dr. Angelou, you're wrong. There's no freedom in belonging nowhere. We have to belong. And it wasn't until it made me angry because I liked us aligning 100% on all things. But then as I started digging into this research, there was a moment when I was sitting with my husband on the couch and I was going through a list of speaking requests, and I came across one that said, come speak at our church. We really like you. We know you're down home, but you cuss too much. So we need you to change the way you talk because you'll offend the faithful. And I kind of felt bad, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I thought I belonged there because I kind of think of myself as the faithful.
Right.
And then like two speaking requests later in the pile, it said, hey, we're super excited to have you come talk to our company. It was a Fortune 100 company. We saw you speak at this leadership summit and you talked about your two main values being courage and faith. And we really love that, but you need to not talk about faith while you're here. We don't talk about that here. And I was like, I looked at Steve and I'm like, oh my God, I belong nowhere. I mean, I don't, like, am I a leadership person? Because that's actually, most people don't know this, but I spend 90% of my time kind of doing leadership development and culture change work. And so I was like, I'm not really a real leadership person, clearly. And I'm obviously not a faith person because I cuss too much. I belong nowhere. And Steve looked at me and he said, you belong anywhere where you just go and you do your work from your heart, because every time you do that, you nail it and you speak to people in a real way. And I was like, yeah, maybe I belong nowhere. I belong everywhere. Oh my God. Wait. I was like, oh my God, that's it. Belong everywhere and I belong nowhere. The thing that's powerful, Joshua, about that interview is that the clip you played was the clip that I played for my class. I actually read the segment to them, but I had never finished watching it. And so when I had this kind of epiphany moment with Steve, I ran to my study and grabbed my laptop and found the interview on YouTube. And if you keep listening, Bill Moyer says, so you don't belong anywhere. You don't belong to anything. And Maya Angelou pauses for a second and she said, I belong to Maya.
Huh.
And I like Maya very much.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that's it. Our level of belonging can never exceed our level of self-worth, our level of belief in self, our level of belonging to self. And when we have that, we carry belonging with us in our heart.
There's one more concept that I'd like you to define based on your research before we get into some of the questions we have on more practically how to apply these concepts. I think it's hard for us to talk about belonging and wholeheartedness without you clarifying your definition from the research of vulnerability. What does it mean to walk in vulnerability?
You know, vulnerability has a simple data-driven, we just crossed the 200,000 mark of data. So we have 200,000 pieces of data. The definition of vulnerability emerged very clear. It's simply uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. And we, most of us, were raised to believe that vulnerability is weakness, but in 200,000 pieces of data, I cannot find a single example of courage that did not require sheer vulnerability. And so I've asked this question all over the country, all over the world, actually. I've said, can you think of one example of courage that you've either engaged in yourself or you've witnessed in someone else that did not require risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure? And the answer is no. In fact, I posed this question to a large group of special forces military, and they actually wanted like 10 minutes to try to figure out the answer because they were like, you know, this cannot be right. And they said, no, there's not an example of courage that is not completely defined and underpinned by vulnerability. So we think of vulnerability as weakness, when in truth, it is our most accurate measure of courage.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's dive in with some of your questions. Paul emailed us, how much does social media play in this bunkering and loneliness? I grew up without internet and social media, was either a church or a club you had to physically attend. Now we are blitzed with discrimination, separation, falsehoods coming at us nonstop. Reality is being made by the biggest mouth with the baddest attitude. Lonely indeed. I jumped off of all social media so that I can enjoy life the way it was when I was a child. We met people on an even playing field. Brene?
Oh my God, I think the answer to the powerful answer to that question is in the question. The answer to it is in the question. He's right. I mean, social media poses a very difficult problem because people feel emboldened to say things to one another they would never say in person, often anonymously, completely disembodied from identity. And we're cruel. We have started to use social media as a place to process pain. And communication with other people is not the place we should be processing pain. And so one of the things that I write about in the book is that social media is great if we use it as a communication tool, but it's not a connection tool.
Can I jump in there for just 1 second? One of the things that you write about also has to do with blame and your definition of blame as a way of discharging pain.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's very interesting, I do this a lot in my leadership work, is people confuse pain, blame and accountability, and they are actually on opposite ends of the same continuum. They're not even really related as a research construct. Blame is simply the discharging of pain and anger, where accountability is an act of vulnerability, of accepting and expressing concern, accepting responsibility, making amends. So this blame, I mean, here's the thing, Joshua, about pain. Pain will never be denied. You cannot drink it away. You cannot drug it away. You cannot surround yourself with material stuff. There's nothing you can do to drown pain. Pain will find a way out. And right now, a lot of us are in pain and we're in fear. We are worried about our families. We're worried about addiction. We're worried about our jobs. We're worried about the environment. We're worried about how we're treating each other. We're worried about divisions in our family. And that fear metastasizes into blame and rage. And when you have leadership, both sides of the aisle, when you have a citizenry that is uncertain and afraid, and you have leadership willing to deliver an enemy to you so that you can deposit your fear and your rage, that is always a very, very seductive formula.
Well, then maybe that's a good way into Katie's question. Katie in Kingston, Illinois, who wrote, "What do we do if we find disrespectful language on Facebook? Do we speak up? How? Or do we avoid the accusation of trolling?"
So I think that's it's a complex question. I think it's context specific, but men and women with the highest levels of true belonging shared 4 practices in common. And each of these practices is a huge paradox. The first one is people are hard to hate close up, so we should move in. The next one is speak truth to BS, but be civil. And so when we see hateful BS on social or in person, we need to speak truth to it while maintaining our civility. One of the scariest trends that I see right now, not just here, but globally, is rampant dehumanization of people. Every genocide in recorded history has started with dehumanization. And every dehumanization effort has started simply with language, what we call each other, the names we call each other. And dehumanization is a tool, and I'll tell you why we use it. We use it because we're actually not biologically wired for cruelty toward each other. We are not wired for hatred, violence, rape, murder, beating. We're not wired for it. And so in order to allow ourselves to do it, to be cruel to other people, the first step is that we have to dehumanize them so we can push people we hate outside of the circle of protected humanity. And what you see from the right and the left right now are people using language that pushes people outside of humanity. And so when I see that kind of stuff on social, I will just delete you. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a political debate. It's a debate about humanity. What side of humanity are you on?
I should also note, we did speak to Emile Bruneau from the University of Pennsylvania, who talked about dehumanization and how some of the polarization politically mirrors or exceeds anything we've seen in society and in humanity in recent years. You'll find that conversation on our website, the1a.org. We're listening back to our conversation with social scientist Brené Brown about her book, Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. We'll get back to it in just a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with social scientist Brené Brown. This originally aired after the release of her book, Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. It's part of a series of conversations looking back on my time as 1A's host. I kind of wonder how you're navigating all this, Brené. People coming to you and saying, oh my goodness, I have this thing. What does your research tell me about what I should do? How are you navigating that?
Yeah, I think it's a really important distinction. So I'm glad you made it. I am not a clinician. So I'm a social scientist and a researcher. And so I have a great therapist I'm willing to share with people, which I highly recommend, but I am not one. And so those kind of really personal applications of the work, probably not my strong suit, because to be honest with you, I think I find myself grappling with, you know, I go into the research, I report with these brave men and women I've interviewed, you know, the patterns and connections that I see in their work and what they're telling me. And then I end up struggling with the research as much as anyone else, to be honest with you. Sometimes I'm just like, damn it, I wish that wasn't true. but it is. And so I think it's a good distinction because I'm really not a therapist.
Well, let's dive in and see what you think about what Katie wrote to us from Ohio. Katie writes, yeah. Ms. Brown's exuberance for connection and vulnerability is admirable. However, sometimes an entire family can be tribe-like. They insist their opinions are absolutely right, in spite of facts that prove otherwise, and insist that others believe as they do. They deliberately shun family members who differ with their dogmatic views of religion, politics, diet, health, etc. How can a member who has the courage to be different survive in this type of family?
Yeah, I wish that was a really uncommon question, but it's, you know, we received thousands of emails after the election from people, and I have a pretty diverse political community on Facebook and that follow the work, and, you know, people saying, I don't know how Thanksgiving's going to work this year, or I just got uninvited, or I don't want to go to my daughter's house, or so I think the conversations about boundary, that's the question, is about boundaries, about what's okay and what's not okay. And so one of the things I was very curious about is how people handled this when I was doing the research. And so I started with my own students. So I teach at the University of Houston, the most ethnically and racially diverse research university in the United States. And so I went to this incredibly diverse group of graduate students, 60 of them, and asked, how many of you struggle with how your family members, struggle with your family members' beliefs, ideas? 85% said they were either somewhere between embarrassed or completely mortified and outraged by how family members felt. Everything from an African-American student who said, my grandparents, I'm very close to my grandparents. We share every political belief except for one, and that's around homosexuality. I'm gay, and my grandfather is a retired pastor and will not be moved on that. Another student said, white student. She said, I have a Latino boyfriend. My father, every time we go eat Mexican food, the waiter walks up and he yells, hola, Pancho, how are you? And the first time he did it, I just went to the bathroom and started crying. And my boyfriend was like, he knows that everyone's name's not Pancho, right? And she's like, I don't know what to do. Then I asked the same 85%, how many of you who struggle with difference within your family are willing to sever those relationships? And not a single person said yes. Then I started asking, so is there no boundary? No matter what, do we still just keep moving in and trying to find a way? But there was one exception, actually two exceptions, and one was physical safety, and the other was the dehumanization piece. It does not work to be in relationship with people who deny your humanity.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that is just not, and for some reason we have decided that it is the people who are traumatized by hatred and bigotry, it's their job to build the table and invite people to sit down and talk about it, which is just not the case. But we certainly think so. So here's what I would say with family. What are the boundaries? And talk about them during a time that is not emotionally escalated. Talk about them during a great time, like, hey, look, I know we all have different beliefs. it's not worth severing our relationship over. Can we talk about what's okay and not okay in terms of how we treat each other when these things come up?
Sean in Kansas City writes, the November election was really jarring for me. Since then, I've been living with the idea of coexisting with others. I bought a coexist bumper sticker for my car, and I'm actually considering having my first tattoo say coexist. I'd want this tattoo to be visible to others. I'm hoping my living in this way will do even just a little to help us be less tribal as a nation. Robert in Westchester, Pennsylvania writes, our country used to be based on the concept of a melting pot. Now there's a strong effort to preserve and protect every other culture distinctly rather than assimilate those cultures into one American culture. We should respect other cultures, but we cannot survive as a country of ideologically distinct cultures. Perhaps, as one example, as a white man, I sympathize with Black Lives Matter, but I can hardly empathize. I don't have black skin. This promotes separation, not connectedness. I wonder if we could contrast these two and this idea of coexistence, the melting pot. From what I took away from the book, coexistence is one level, but you're talking about something closer. I mean, there's a chapter in your book called Hold Hands with Strangers. There's another one called People Are Hard to Hate Close Up, Move In. So it feels like you're talking about something more uncomfortable and more difficult than coexistence that sits right in the discomfort that Robert is feeling about, say, Black Lives Matter? Or am I reading this wrong?
No, I think you just wove those together perfectly. You know, I have labeled what I think we're in right now as a spiritual crisis of disconnection. And when I say spiritual crisis, it makes people uncomfortable because they think religion or dogma, but I'm not talking about that. The way I define spirituality is the deeply held belief that we're inextricably connected to each other by something greater than us. And that thing that's greater than us is rooted in love and compassion. And the real key to spirituality is a deeply held belief of inextricable connection. And so does that manifest itself as just coexisting with one another? You know, on a bad day, I think that's the goal. But I think there's something deeper. I think what we need to remember is that we are inextricably connected to each other by the human spirit. And that, while unbreakable, it is forgettable. We can forget it. We can forget that we are connected to each other in a way that is unbreakable. And so the whole idea of holding hands with strangers, the whole idea of leaning into collective moments of joy and pain with people, whether it's, you know, a concert or a play or at a funeral, this idea of having instances of real connection between strangers to continually remind us of that inextricable connection was one of the practices that emerged from the men and women who had the strongest sense of true belonging.
And just to be clear, I'm sorry, you're talking about physical connection. Facebook, Twitter, that's not the same thing.
No, it's not the same thing. I mean, again, if you can use Facebook to figure out where everybody's going to meet up, that's awesome. But this needs to happen in person. And that's not just my research. We know that in-person connection does something even chemically to us that online does not. Online communities can be a great platform, a launching pad for real connection in person, but they are not a replacement. The thing about Black Lives Matter, there's a couple things I want to say about that because I think it's super important and relevant for the research. One is I can't have empathy for something that I haven't experienced. That is a mythology around empathy. Empathy is not about shared experience. It's about shared emotion. So one of the questions I ask people when we're teaching empathy in graduate, because I teach in a graduate college of social work, is, do you know rage? Do you know pain? Do you know joy? Do you know grief? Do you know love? If you know these emotions, then you're qualified for empathy. Because when someone shares something with us that's difficult, our job is not to try to reflect that experience from our past. Oh yeah, I remember a time when that was happening. It's about digging in deeper to, do I remember a time when I felt powerless, when I felt afraid, when I felt enraged?
Hmm.
That's what empathy is. Empathy is connecting with an emotion that someone else is experiencing. We're not great at it because it requires emotional fluency. And we just had a new set of research emerge that shows that there are 30 emotions that we need to be kind of fluent in order to truly be empathic. And the average number that people recognize in terms of emotion is 3, happy, sad, pissed off. So some emotional granularity is helpful in being empathetic, but we can all do that. I don't have to have experienced, I don't have to be African American or Black to know what rage is and to know what powerlessness is and to find something in me that can connect with that pain.
Right.
I do, however, have to be courageous and brave and be willing to acknowledge that pain in myself.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to get in one more audience question before we're low on time. Betsy wrote on our website, the1a.org, can you talk about how belonging and friendship work together? Now in my 40s, I find that I have lots of friends, but I have a difficult time finding the depth of friendship I had when I was younger. How do you bridge that gap? Briefly.
I think it was easier when we were younger because I think we were truer to each other and to ourselves, and there was less to lose, so there was less armor. I think the number of friendships, my data, the loneliness data, the number of friendships is not relevant. It's the depth of a relationship that matters. And so what I would say is, if you picture belonging as a posse or a squad or a crew, that's mythology. That's a commercial for beer. Real belonging. Yeah, real belonging, one or two people who love you, not despite your imperfection and vulnerability, but because of it.
Can I nerd out with you about Harry Potter for 1 second?
Oh, my God, always. Are you kidding? What house are you?
I'd like to believe I'm a Gryffindor, I think. I hope.
I took the test like 3 times. I kept coming up Ravenclaw until I finally nudged myself into Gryffindor because I figured out the test.
You gamed the test. Okay, here's why I wanted to bring up Harry Potter. It's an analogy for, I think, part of the challenge that we have with talking about this. And when I learned you were a Harry Potter fan, I immediately thought about Defense Against the Dark Arts. This narrative over, you know, right? Like the whole 7 books, every year there's a different instructor and there's this subplot about the right way to teach people to deal with evil. Do you confront them with it or do you talk about it in a textbook? And I feel like, you know, as we're winding down our conversation, that's kind of my pop culture geeky analogy for a lot of what you're navigating with is these awful emotions that you're asking us to deal with in this book and in a lot of your work. I think it would just be more comfortable to talk about them and not to hold me by the hand and walk me toward a boggart or toward a dementor and teach me how to cast a Patronus. Like, that's scary. What do you say to people who would just as soon take the textbook, pass Dolores Umbridge's test, and walk away?
I would say, who wants to learn from Dolores Umbridge, is what I would say. I mean, like it's so funny because my kids both say, Mom, you're a Defense of the Dark Arts teacher.
You kind of are.
End up either, you're either dead or in a box. So I do think, and one day, I swear, one day I'm going to teach a college class called Defense of the Dark Arts.
I would love that. Please make it an online course.
I will.
I would love that.
But I will, and I'm going to use the Dementors as a metaphor for shame.
I think that's a good one. I think that's a good one. We're very low on time. I wonder if before we run out of time, for the folks who are looking at this, who are beginning to say, okay, maybe I do need to learn how to engage with this myself. There are a lot of guides in the book, but is there one first step that you think that everybody or just about anybody can take, should take to kind of get on the path to true belonging or even to assess where they are on the path?
Yeah, I think it's the strongest advice that came from the research, and that is stop walking through the world looking for evidence that you don't belong because you will always find it. You carry belonging in your heart. You don't negotiate it externally. And no one belongs here more than you. We just have to stop looking for evidence that we don't.
And what's next for you? What are you working on next?
I don't know. Can't decide. I'm torn. Maybe something at Hogwarts.
You know, I think if you let yourself fall down that rabbit hole, you're going to like it down there.
And I think so too.
I think so. I think you're really going to enjoy it down there. And also, if there are more resources, I believe, on your site for people who are trying to learn more about this, right?
Yes, they can visit us at brenebrown.com.
Okay. And you are, just in the last few seconds, what aspect of all this would you like to be better at for yourself?
Speaking truth to BS while being civil.
Civility?
I'm good at part one, and part two, I can get, you know, my gift is my passion and my curse is my passion.
I hear that. Brené Brown, the new book is called Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. She's also a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Brené Brown, what a pleasure to spend the hour with you. Thanks for talking to us.
So fun. Thank you.
That conversation originally aired back in 2017. Over the next month, you'll hear a handful of my favorite conversations during my 3 years as host, marking what will be my last month on the show. Remember, you'll find the 1A podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's a great way to catch up on shows and guests you might have missed. If you'd leave us a review, we really appreciate it. That will help other people find us. There's more at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.